Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Sheldon Toplett, Evan Brown, and me. We're going to talk about things in TV shows, things in movies, and the licenses there, too, including fuzzy Jane hats, and what you can do if you're a knitter. We're going to talk about CISPA making its way to a House vote. Lots of things regarding LinkedIn and YouTube and cyberbullying. Great topics all coming up next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 206, recorded April 12th, 2013. One hat to sue them all. Hi there, I'm Denise Howell, and you've tuned in for This Week in Law. Welcome, we're thrilled you're here. We've got a great panel and some really interesting topics on the verge of technology and law, that intersection where things get gray and fuzzy and complicated, but we're going to try and make them more clear here today. We've got Sheldon Toplett joining us once again on the show. Hello, Sheldon.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Evan. How are you?
We're great. Good to see you again. It's been a while, but we're thrilled to have you back.
Yes, well, I'm certainly gray and fuzzy, so I'm the person that.
Yes, we're all getting grayer and fuzzier every day. Sheldon writes a fabulous blog called The Unruly of Law and teaches from time to time as well as practicing, correct?
Yes, that's right. I teach media law at Boston University and Emerson College.
Perfect. All right. And also joining us is Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy Friday. You know, gray and fuzzy is fine. I was thinking more warm and fuzzy, but, you know, we get what, or we take what we can get, I guess, right?
Yes, we do. How are things at the Info Law Group?
Things are going great, you know, busy, good. Doing interesting stuff. So, you know, it's always always good to kind of take a break from the real world and have a conversation about the higher levels of things here on TWiL. So it's really good to be here. Looking forward to it.
Yes, well, our first story is going to start at about as high a level as you can get, things worn on one's head that are indeed fuzzy, and it's a copyright story. I mean, I think it's a copyright story. There may be other kinds of intellectual property that are being implicated here. But for anyone who is a fan of the old Fox TV show that was canceled far too early, Firefly, this is a big deal. And it's a really interesting intellectual property discussion. What happened here, and there is an amazing breakdown of all of the events in this saga over at BuzzFeed. This concerns hats. Little fuzzy hand-knitted orange and yellow hats with ear flaps that are known as the Jane hat. And this hat made a brief appearance on Firefly when Jane Cobb, one of the characters, received said hat, or a hat like these hats, from his mother on the show and then proceeded to wear it throughout the episode. And it has become this rallying point for fans of the show who have obtained their own version of these hats, mostly from knitters around the world who are also Firefly fans, who have found a need and a demand for these hats and started knitting them. And of course, sold them on places such as Etsy, where you can readily sell handmade items. And, you know, having a knitter in the family myself, my mother is an avid knitter. I am very sympathetic to this story on a number of levels. What happened here is ThinkGeek, you know, who we love, who everybody who is in the technology world, you know, has probably bought something or read something over at ThinkGeek at one point or another. ThinkGeek also saw that there was a need and a demand to supply Firefly fandom with Jane hats and entered into an agreement with a small company that had the license from Fox. That company was called, let's see if I can find it here.
Ripple Junction.
What was
Ripple
it?
Ripple Junction.
Yeah, there it is. So they actually worked with Ripple Junction to develop and tweak the hat that they were going to sell at Think Geek so that it was, you know, it had the proper specifications and color and fuzziness that they wanted for fans who might buy it on their site. But now that there was an officially licensed version out there, Fox went on the offensive and started doing take-now notices for all the individual, independent, unlicensed knitters out there who were making their own and have been doing so for quite some time. So as you can imagine, on the internet, these letters became public and people were vastly upset. The notices people were receiving, and again, some of them are reproduced in the BuzzFeed piece, give very unspecified reasons for requesting the takedown, such as, let's see, here's from Etsy Legal notifying one such seller that their copyright and intellectual property policy had been violated. Really nothing too specific about, you know, what about these hats were problematic. More specificity was provided by Fox, but really nothing too clarifying. They specify that they are the owner of copyright, trademark, and other intellectual property rights related to Firefly. These rights include characters, images, designs, slogans, and or other distinctive creative elements of the series. And they have the exclusive right to license and merchandise such things. So, Evan, what do you think? Is this not... Let's look at it from the legal standpoint first. Do you think that Fox has anything to stand on here as far as enforcing independent replicas of a hat mm-hmm. that appeared on a show?
Right. I know you're asking to just get straight to the legal questions here. And I guess there's really that really, you know, that kind of breaks down, you know, when we talk about the legal questions, we can't also talk about just kind of the business and tactical decisions that Fox is making to actually try to enforce whatever rights it has here. In the discussion, most of the commentary about this story that's out there, there are a few issues that really have been, I guess, taken as given, and we haven't really gone in and examined those things. And those issues are whether or not there really is anything that Fox truly does own here. The notices that have become public from Etsy, you know, to these sellers who are getting these notices from Fox, you know, akin to, you know, a DMCA takedown notice, kind of in that same genre there, are claiming violation of the copyright and intellectual property rights that Fox has in this. So that presents the question, what intellectual property rights are those? Are they really copyright protected works of Fox? You know, is there the requisite amount of originality that goes into these hats? I mean, yes, it is, you know, unique, but is it original in the sense that the Copyright Act requires of something that's actually, you know, from a creative spark and something that's not what they would call sans affaire, just, you know, kind of out there, these stock imagery, you know, a yellow and orange hat like this, you know, like this. Certainly that design for the Jane hat has been around for probably centuries. And, you know, is there enough originality in just combining the orange and the yellow? So I'm just kind of going off on this one little point here. Is there really a protectable copyright interest at all? And this is one way of examining that question. You know, is there some kind of trademark or, you know, kind of identification type of issue that's underlying what's making Fox angry in all this? You know, is that something that attaches that Fox should have rights in kind of the context of likelihood of confusion? Is Fox really saying implicitly that consumers out there in the marketplace in this very kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of intimate sort of cottage industry where brown coats know one another and kind of support one another and are very much into it and are fully aware of that this stuff is handcrafted. Is there really a confusion that that actually is should come from Fox, or that Fox really is the owner of those rights and that it indicates the source of those entertainment services? See, it's even kind of weird to articulate these questions because the reality of it starts to break down after a while. So all of those things, you know, need to be there in place to establish, or not all of those things, but there needs to be something there to establish intellectual property rights in the first place to substantiate Fox as the purported owner of this intellectual property and taking the aggressive position that it has taken toward these independent creators on Etsy. And that just sets aside for a moment the question of whether or not this is actually caused by ThinkGeek's relationship with this Ripple Junction. I had to remember, mm-hmm. I knew it was something with a Grateful Dead song, something Ripple there somewhere. So, you know, is there, you know, what's the correlation between Fox's aggressive actions toward Etsy users and purveyors and, you know, to that whole transaction there? So that's, you know, at best kind of a sketch of the legal context for all this. I think the larger question really is, you know, why is Fox doing this? And, you know, given the fact that the show has been off the air for, man, can you really believe it, 11 years, what sort of trademark rights would it even care about at this point, to the extent that it hasn't abandoned those rights altogether? Yes, it's still, the show, I guess, is still on reruns on the Science Channel. So, yes, Fox probably does have a continuing use in commerce of this stuff, to the extent that those trademark rights begin in the first place. But, wow, it just kind of leaves a scratch in our heads. Like, why is this happening? And, you know, I hope it's for some reason other than just opportunistic, you know, corporate capitalistic greed, or however you want to characterize it in a cynical way.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that there's only a correlation of timing between when this licensed product became available and when the takedown notices started going out. And we can't really, you know, draw definitive conclusions from that. But it sure seems convenient that now there's a way to receive royalties from the sales of these hats in one venue and not in others. And the others are the ones that Fox is targeting.
What an interesting little slip you made there, saying loyalty for royalty, you know, because yes. It really, that's the outcry from the community. It's like, oh, we're loyal to this. Why are you trying to, and this is not my term, this is something I got from IRC. Why is Fox trying to hose Firefly fans once again? You know, why is that?
This raises so many interesting issues because, you know, the copyright world of knitters is an interesting one in its own right, you know, as far as patterns and originality of creative works there. And I think, Evan, as you were pointing out, it's probably a good guess that, you know, when the folks working at Fox came up, you know, the prop master who decided, here's the hat that Jane's mom is going to send, you know, they may well have gone to somewhere like Etsy and tried to find the funniest colored, most homespun looking hat they could find and then modeled something after that. So, you know, I think the chicken egg question here is unresolved. And also if there is, now this is an entertainment law question I don't know the answer to, if there is a distinctive thing, and again, this only appeared for a few minutes on the show and only became distinctive because the fans latched onto it and made it so. But leaving aside the issues that raises, if there is a distinctive thing that's associated with a brand, if that is appearing on a television show, doesn't it still have to be registered? Wouldn't you have to seek a actual registered mark in that in order to be able to enforce it? Sheldon, do you know the answer to that?
No, but it does seem to me that I would tend to think yes. I mean, that seems like a logical approach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sorry, go right ahead.
No, you go right ahead.
Oh, I mean, I was just going to say, you know, that once you get your head around the concept of using Fox and originality in the same sentence, still, I think it's not really, you know, it's an unusual thing. I agree with Evan that it really just seems to be corporate opportunism. There doesn't seem to be any logical approach. This isn't a case of Fox marketing these products, so like, you know, Gucci bag knockoffs or something, people putting out counterfeits. They're not defending something. It's an old, dead show. I think they tried to make a movie and it didn't happen. And you really don't want to, agitate the cult TV viewers, because they have a lot of clout. You know, they just recently had a went to Kickstarter to bring back some program, that had been canceled. Do you know which one I'm referring to? Is a woman. She was like the daughter of a cop, and she was a Valerie Mars or something like that, Heather Mars, whatever.
Veronica but that was Mars, yes.
Veronica Mars, thank you. And so they have an impact, but it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. I think Fox is saying that, well, if there's any opportunity for us to get money out of this, let's see. But it's not a very good business decision or legal decision to pursue this, I think.
All right. So, Evan, someone calls you up. They're an Etsy seller. They have created their own individual pattern for a hat that they've been selling. They have been selling it as a Jane hat, let's assume, making the association with the show. And they've received one of these notices and have been told never to sell this item again because it infringes unspecified intellectual property belonging to Fox. What do you tell them?
Well, there's the practical way of approaching the question, and then there's the law school hypothetical way, law school exam hypothetical way of telling them how to respond. And the practical answer is going to be, do you really want to jeopardize your whole Etsy existence on this? Do you really want to take a stand? If so, go ahead and start, keep selling, keep trying to sell. The second part of that, we're still in the practical part is, okay, well, if you want to litigate this, if you want to file a declaratory judgment action or something, better put 5-6 figures aside as a war chest of trying to get, fight Fox on these intellectual property issues. So now let's get into the more, money is no object, practicalities are out the window analysis of it. I think that there could be some really interesting discovery into this question that I was talking about and kind of teeing the issue up here of what intellectual property rights Fox is really asserting here. And, is there really something that is there? If Fox is going to assert copyright interest in this, they would have to show that there was a registration of the copyright in this. And I just did a quick cursory search on the Copyright Office website before the show and didn't find anything. But man, Fox has so many gazillion copyright registrations. I have no illusions to think that my search was comprehensive. So they would need a copyright registration for this.
Right. Can I jump in right there? What would they register? Would they register the pattern? Would they register the hat? Because the hat is more, of a visual thing and perhaps a trademark associated with the brand. Would they register the bit of film? Of course they have registered the bit of film that included the appearance of the hat on TV.
Right.
So I'm bewildered as to what they would even be able to register and then in turn enforce.
Right. Because the whole question of the copyrightability of fashion is very kind of open. There's not strong copyright protection for fashion to begin with, like patterns of clothing, and it's based both on kind of the fashion industry norms and some substantive law as well. So, there could be, there's certainly a work of the visual arts, in as much as there's a 2D rendering of it. Definitely the audiovisual work in which it's embodied as well. So that might militate toward, actually, I think I misused the word militate. I think militate is only against, right? So that would kind of maybe cause us to shift our analysis to think that it's more toward a trademark issue here. And I don't think they would need a trademark registration for that. They could claim some kind of unregistered common law rights in the trademark and the goodwill associated with that. The Lanham Act, Section 43A of the Trademark Act it can be read pretty broadly to give a lot of power to plaintiffs for, false association, false endorsement, false advertising, indications of source that are misleading to the public. So I think there's all kinds of things that Fox could assert in that realm. But I mean, gosh, look at how nuanced it is for us just to articulate what the issues are. Look at, correspondingly, maybe multiply it times 10 to figure out the nuances of what the discovery would be like to find those things. You know, the market research that would have to go into it. I mean, this would be an extremely expensive piece of litigation to take on. So if we're going to couch it in terms of the, you know, kind of the typical Etsy user, and, you know, I don't think there's any danger in stereotyping here. A lot of Etsy users are people working from their homes and very, you know, not the sorts that have the means to pursue really expensive and complex litigation against the behemoth type of opponent here. So all things being equal otherwise, Fox may very well be finding that it's perfectly positioned to do this because it recognizes that it won't get any serious pushback other than the negativity that's emerging from the sum total of all the controversy and the loyal fan base, the loyal community of brown coats who are talking about these things.
It's really pretty sad because, you know, if you read through that BuzzFeed story, it seems like folks who are diehard fans of the show will wear these hats around and in public to sort of, you know, self-identify at conferences. Apparently, you see hundreds of them. And it seems like, you know, that will no longer be the case. And so from a business standpoint, Fox is probably not doing itself any favors if it does, in fact, want to sell the licensed hat. It seems like the fans would probably make that no longer a viable business venture.
It's gonna make these things so much more popular. You know,
I mean,
I don't think it'd be a hot item particularly.
That way, you know, you can multiply a low number to make it, you know, if there's, you know, a few hundred of these out there in the marketplace, there may be a few thousand, you know, based on this. Because, I mean, there still could be great peer-to-peer distribution models for this stuff. You know, the fact that Etsy sellers are going to be under attack is not going to diminish the efforts of, you know, Firefly enthusiasts to get their wares out there and to trade and share and to, you know, be part of a community. And they'll be bolstered by this. I don't see how it could really have much of a negative effect. It could only have kind of a Streisand-like effect, which is what it's having. We wouldn't be talking about these things otherwise.
Right. And there was an interesting case raised by Mark Lemley, who's been on the show before, professor at Stanford and very renowned legal scholar, brings up a case called Sed Non Olet Denarius. And it involved the Los Angeles Dodgers. And the court there held they were not able to go after the Brooklyn Dodger businesses, saying they had abandoned the name Brooklyn Dodgers by moving the team and angering the fans. So it was a case about trademark abandonment. So, you know, if somebody really wanted to plant their flag and take on Fox on this, that's something they could perhaps argue. Sheldon, any further thoughts on this?
No, I think that's pretty. I was going to make the abandonment argument also, but again, I think it is a, you know, I think the hat wearers, it's a narrow community. They kind of define themselves as, you know, a potential dating pool. I suppose that's about it. But I don't think it's going to go much further than this. And I do think, from a business standpoint, it's not Fox's best decision.
Eric Deckman says in IRC that two of his sisters knit and he's wondering where to get the pattern. I'm assuming that there are probably patterns out there that are not hard to find.
Well, so we can make it kind of, we could like segue into 3D printing with that. You know, wow, Fox is going to go after you even distributing the pattern because you're going to render it in three dimensions with your own, you know, hands and knitting needles. So crazy story.
That's right. Now we just need the 3D knitting printer. I don't know that exists yet, but folks get to work. Let's make unshiny our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Firefly fans will get the reference. Unshiny.
So do you think your mom would make you one? I mean, have you ever
asked her? Oh, I'm sure she would. Yeah, if I asked. Yeah. Although it's not really her standard fare. She tends to knit things that are a little bit more, I would say, less homespun looking. Yes, she's a little bit more fashion forward in her knitting. But what could be more fashion forward than an orange and yellow hat with red ear flaps and a pom-pom on top? I don't know.
Depends on who you ask, I guess.
All right. Well, we're kind of talking about Hollywood already, so let's continue in that vein and discuss some more entertainment stories. So this is kind of a good follow-on to what we're discussing. What happens intellectual property-wise when things appear in films or on television? Evan, I think you tweeted this out earlier this week. Very fascinating amicus brief filed on behalf of the MPAA in a case by a fan of the Baltimore Ravens who made a logo, designed a logo for the Ravens that the football team then used for a few years without any permission or payment to him. Frederick Bouchat. Is the plaintiff in this case. This is written up over at Tech Dirt by Mike Masnick. And now there is a documentary film that includes footage of the Ravens playing in uniforms that bore this unauthorized logo made by the fan. And he is suing for copyright infringement because this appeared in the movie. And the amicus brief that was filed, this was filed by the MPAA, and they went to Stanford Law School and got the Center for Internet and Society and lawyers there to draft up a fair use argument. Why in this documentary film context, there shouldn't be any way to enforce and fair use should protect the use of this kind of, not just this kind of logo in a film, but really anything that is copyrighted in a documentary film. The argument that they're making is that it would be impossible for us to document our past and examine it and relive it without using intellectual property protected material in one way or another. And I believe this is an issue that you raised on the show recently, Evan, as well, that it's going to be impossible for us to maintain good historical records without infringing various copyrights. So Mike Masnick thinks it's hysterical that the MPAA is arguing for fair use and has commissioned folks involved with the Stanford Fair Use Project to make the arguments on their behalf. But there it is. You know, he's fairly skeptical that the same organization who denies that there is any implication of free speech in enforcing copyright laws now is coming out so strongly in favor of fair use in this particular case. But, you know, we're all inconsistent in our own ways. Are you as surprised, Evan, that the MPAA has taken this stance?
No, I'm not all that surprised. I think it's intriguing. It's interesting. But, you know, I don't get the giggles out of it that Mike Masnick does, because for a couple of reasons. One, the MPAA is still trying to go after the little guy in this situation. This Bouchat guy, who's the plaintiff against the Baltimore Ravens in this situation, he's a, you know, he's a small independent creator. And, you know, he has come up empty-handed so many times in several rounds of litigation with the Baltimore Ravens for really them ripping off his artwork. And he's gotten essentially no compensation, even though that his work was widely used, widely commercially exploited, and is still being exploited in these documentary films and in playbacks and displays in the stadium in Baltimore and all that stuff here. So for one way of looking at it is that the MPAA is still trying to go after the little guy in much the same way that they were in filing mass lawsuits against individuals accused of trading films, you know, in the early to mid part of the last decade. So that's one reason why this is not necessarily inconsistent with its position. The other reason that it's not all that surprising is that, you know, when we think about the MPAA and when we think of our criticisms of it when it comes to copyright policy and, you know, big content when it comes like this, it's the way that we think that it's overbroad and too sweeping in its mass litigation efforts, suing all these people for trading protected works through some peer-to-peer technology. In those cases, fair use barely comes up. The issue in those cases is whether or not the defendant copied the work verbatim. It's quite the unusual case where there's some kind of creative use being articulated here. So yes, I'm sure that there are situations where the MPAA has argued against fair use, against, you know, subsequent use of its works. But that to me doesn't really seem like the fair use hasn't really been the issue that we have come up with to criticize the MPAA for its tactics in the past. So it's kind of like, yeah, it's interesting that they're taking a position that is anti-copyright maximalism, but it really doesn't get right at the heart of them being inconsistent with the position that they've taken thus far, which is going after widespread piracy, which is the alleged verbatim copying of works, not even introducing the issue of whether that subsequent use by the defendant is transformative. So yes, it's intriguing. Yes, it's interesting that they've gotten the Stanford fair use folks, but I think at the bottom, at the fundamental level of the analysis, they're not saying anything that's really antithetical to their position the way it's been all along. So there you go.
Well, it's a good case for us to discuss right after talking about the Jane hat, because this guy, Frederick Bouchat, is kind of like the person, pre-prop master who made the original Jane hat and had his work used in a commercial way here by a football team, and then subsequently put on film, and just wants to be compensated for it. Sheldon, do you think it's right that he seems to be out in the cold here?
This is a situation where, I've blogged about the MPAA and their pursuit of, internet streamers, I think film streamers at one point, and neither they nor the NFL are the most sympathetic parties, and you got to give Mr. Bouchat props for his perseverance, if nothing else. He's sued a lot. It's been an epic struggle against these guys, but I think that I actually buy into fair use argument, the use of copywriting material to document, historical events and stuff. The impact of this really is serious. I think of like news organizations and documentarians and public broadcasters and the like, who want to, be able to present an accurate account of, of some past event, historical event. And if you're always going to have guys like Bouchat who can step up and say, wait a minute, in that footage, there's this work, there's this hat I made, or there's this logo I designed. It's really going to, turn things on its ear. And I'm sort of just sympathetic, on the side of the people who would be hurt by a positive ruling by Bouchat. It's not just the Baltimore Ravens, but a group like the American Library Association or things of that sort. I tend to throw in with them. Old-fashioned Massachusetts liberal.
Eric Gardner, writing over at The Hollywood Reporter, Esquire, summarized one of the outcomes of the cases brought by Mr. Bouchat, where a judge declared most of the uses of the logo to be fair use. Talking through the fair use factors, the judge factored in the purpose and character of the use, the nature of the copyrighted work, the amount used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole, and the effect of the use upon the potential market for the copyrighted work. The only use that fell outside of fair use was the way in which Bouchat's logo was incorporated into a video game. It seems really hard for me to get my head around the fact that a judge walked through the fair use factors and found that all this was fair use. I mean, it seems like the logo was used, if you look at the two logos side by side over in the Tech Dirt piece, they're very, very similar. There's a bit of a change in the one that was used by the Ravens, where the tail feathers of the Ravens seem to be removed from the bottom. But other than that, they're very, very similar logos. I could see a judge definitely going the other way on these.
Yeah,
fair
use factors.
Because
it's certainly for profit. It's for profit. That's usually a factor that goes against, you know, and also, you know, the percentage of it. Well, you say, well, the logo's just on a helmet and, you know, the rest of the uniform doesn't have it. I don't know. I mean, I see your point, too. I guess I just think the documentarians and news people have to be protected from any kind of misconstruing or misinterpretation of a finding for Bouchot in this case.
Right. Yeah, I could definitely see when you're factoring in documentary films that that changes the calculus considerably. You know, if you're just looking at whether the Baltimore Ravens could misappropriate the logo without any sort of penalty, I think that would be a different analysis. Evan, anything further on this?
No. This, you know, just I didn't expect this iteration of this, you know, this Baltimore Ravens story. I mean, this has been going on for so long, and you know, it's kind of a story that artists and fair use proponents have been watching so far, or you know, pretty closely so far. So I'm really surprised to see the MPAA's involvement like this. But like I said earlier, I don't think at the end of the day, it's necessarily inconsistent with what we have come to expect from the MPAA all along, and I join in Sheldon's comments as well, even though I would not put myself in the same camp as an old school Massachusetts liberal generally. But, you know, given the important interest to culture and the assimilation or the aggregation and collection of our culture for posterity, I think that these fair use issues are very important. It would be difficult to overstate how important they are.
Right. All right. Well, one other context in which fair use comes up all the time and maybe does not get as much play as it should is whether or not things should stay on YouTube when a DMCA takedown notice has been sent. And there's a really interesting piece posted on the newmediarights.org site with some investigative evidence gathering from someone named Patrick McKay, who believes he has uncovered through correspondence from YouTube to people who have filed counter notices to DMCA takedowns, that YouTube may have side agreements with some large copyright holders, including Universal Music Group for one, where they have contractually told these folks that even in the event a counter notice is filed, they are, as long as the rights holder reiterates what they have said in their initial takedown notice, they're not going to put the video back in response to the counter notice. So it seems a little convoluted, and they're sort of drawing implications from correspondence that has been sent to folks who have filed counter notices. But it's an interesting thing, and it looks like he might be on to something here. Sheldon, I think you put this in our links.
Is this the Google transparency?
No, this is maybe you didn't put this in. This is
no,
the.
No, I don't think I did.
Oh, maybe I put it in.
It's one of those things.
Yeah, who knows? At the end of the day, but it's pretty interesting. What YouTube seems to have told certain users is that it enters into agreements with certain music copyright owners to allow use of their sound recordings and musical compositions. In exchange for this, some of these music copyright owners require us to handle videos containing their sound recordings and or musical works in ways that differ from the usual processes on YouTube. The other interesting thing that Patrick, let's see, what's his name again?
McKay.
Scrolling. Patrick McKay has called out is that buried in its terms of service for people who are uploading things to YouTube, is that YouTube reserves to itself the right to decline to reinstate a video in response to a counter notice at its sole discretion. So, Evan, did you look through this and do you think there's something going on here?
There might be something going on here, and you know, if there is, I wonder how surprised we should be that there indeed is. What this does is gives us occasion to look at the DMCA specifically Section 512G, which talks about counter notifications. And what we're talking about here, just to, you know, just to rough sketch it, you know, the copyright owner sends a DMCA takedown notice. The provider, like YouTube, takes the content down, tells the subscriber about it, and the subscriber can say, no, 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 put it back. I really have the rights. And what we're uncovering here is YouTube saying, thanks, but no thanks. We're not going to. And the whole concept of counter notification comes into this via Section 512G, what we're talking about here, to limit the liability. Limit the liability for what? No, not to limit the liability for copyright infringement, but to limit the liability of the platform to its user for having taken the content down. So I suspect, and I don't know, I haven't gone back and read the legislative history or interviewed any people who were members of Congress in 1998, but I would suspect that this whole limitation on liability, the question of liability from the platform to its users, was contemplated for those situations where the user is actually paying the platform for the right and privilege and opportunity and the business right to have his or her content hosted and made available to the public by way of that platform. Because what you could envision is a platform disabling access to content in violation of its agreement with that user, but it needs to be able to say, hey, we've got to leave this down because we are facing copyright infringement liability from this third party. Even though we're in breach of our contract with you, we need to have some protection here. So what YouTube is doing here, I think, is recognizing that Section 512G is essentially toothless when you're dealing with subscribers to your service who aren't paying anything. What kind of liability could YouTube possibly be concerned about to its user for having disabled this content? YouTube ain't the government. There's no First Amendment problem here. It's not charging anybody, most users to post content in situations like this. Whereas it has these interests of big content, the record labels, which has been a huge boon to YouTube. I mean, think of what YouTube would be like if there wasn't, if Content ID hadn't come along and there'd been this monetization system put in place for there to be all this, copyrighted content from big media there for everyone to enjoy. Oh, and by the way, for YouTube to make a lot of money off of. So why not? I mean, if you're looking at YouTube and you're looking to the fiduciary duty it owes to its investors to monetize and all this stuff, that Google, the fiduciary duty that Google has to monetize, who cares about the user here? We don't have to put this stuff up. Let's have this agreement with the record labels, that says we're just going to ignore this risk of liability, which is minuscule to begin with. Section 512G is really toothless in this situation. If YouTube was all that concerned about it, maybe there's even a provision in the agreement with the record labels for indemnification. Maybe the record labels agreed to pick up the tab if YouTube got sued under Section 512G. The suit wouldn't necessarily be under 512G. It would be a suit for damages for failing to put the content up pursuant to this counter notification. Right. Maybe a record label says, hey, we'll pick up the tab. What's that going to be, 10 grand? When we're going to be making $10 billion off of this over the next few years, what's 10 grand to us? So to get back to the original question, sure, there probably is something going on here. Is there anything we can do about it? Probably not. Should we have a little bit of righteous indignation about it? Fine. But it's not going to accomplish a whole lot at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, it does further illustrate that going back to our discussion of fair use, that it's incredibly hard to enforce fair use rights in the YouTube ecosystem. And this seems to be a complicating factor that weighs even more heavily against users being able to say, I realize that this may be copyrighted work, but I can use it nonetheless. Or, in some instances, it's not even copyrighted work at all that's in question. Sheldon, do you have any thoughts on this?
No, other than I do agree with Evan about the toothlessness of Section G, 512G, but I otherwise, no. I have to confess, I'm the like the law student in class who was called on to brief the case. He didn't brief. I skipped over that one somehow.
All right. Well, we certainly won't hold you to it. We'll exclude that from the test at the end of the show. All right. Let's have a quick privacy story next. Just worth mentioning for anyone who is following whether or not a class action can be pursued against ComScore, U.S. District Judge James Holderman has decided, yes, indeed, it can. And what ComScore is being sued for is the degree to which it collects information, what's characterized as a terrifying amount of data. By the plaintiffs, including usernames, passwords, search queries, credit card numbers, and retail transactions. ComScore is the web analytic company that tells you, you know, how much time Google Plus users on average stay on the site. They have very, very fine-grained analytic data that they can provide to their customers and to the world at large. And the way they gather this data, apparently, is they seed their software in with other things that are given away for free. And then it runs on your system and collects information about what you're doing online. So they're being sued for that. There's a smaller subgroup of people who weren't shown a hyperlink to ComScore's end user license agreement before downloading the software. So there are two actual classes of people involved in this suit as plaintiffs. And it's an interesting case because it involves disclosure. You know, what the parties actually agreed to, what people were told about what kind of information was going to be gathered about them. That's what the case will turn on. Sheldon, do you think that as this case proceeds, and especially in light of the fact that a class has now been certified, that ComScore is going to scramble to settle and move on?
I think they probably will, because it's a, this case is in, of course, Evan's backyard in Northern Illinois. But this is a, when I read about it, it brought to mind Fraley Facebook case, which I am familiar with, where Facebook was, eager to, dole out $20 million to settle against this sort of putative class that hadn't yet actually been certified, unlike here, putative class who were all upset about the sponsored story ads that appear in Facebook, the ones that would come up and say Shirley likes Taco Bell. And of course, Shirley's friends would say, well, if they're really her friends, they do an intervention. But Shirley's friends would say, she likes Taco Bell. That's great. And of course, Shirley's not getting any payment for this. And she didn't consent. She didn't give her permission for that to happen. So it's, it's the same thing here. The argument that, people were non-informed about the breadth of the information that these guys are allegedly building up. But the one aspect of any kind of settlement that did come up in the Fraley case, I mean, here the parties did try to, hammer it out, and the judge initially was reluctant, is that, it looks like in this settlement, all the money's going to the lawyers and not to the so-called injured users. And, they would set up in a way that there was attorney's fees, and then Facebook was going to be giving a lot of money to these various freedom kind of online freedom groups and other groups and the like. And so I suppose here, I suppose they could make the, ComScore might face this too. So how much were you really harmed by this? If somebody was gathering, you took these credit cards, you were playing this game, you're doing using a screensaver, there's no such, how unsophisticated are you? There's no such thing as a freebie, so I suppose what harm you actually suffered might be the issue. But it is a I do think that, yeah, it's not too late to give a short answer. I do think that ComScore will try to get rid of this case in a hurry.
Yeah, it's a good lesson for companies that do harvest this kind of data, that you better be super clear about what you're going to gather and how it's going to be used. And, it's not just California that has stringent laws along those lines, I guess there are federal privacy laws implicated in this case. So
at least ComScore fessed up to it. Google was always like they accidentally captured all this information, right?
Whoops, it just fell into our back pocket.
Right.
All right, well, it's an interesting case, and we'll continue to watch it. By the way, I'm a class member in the Fraley case and submitted my claim to part of the settlement, whatever that may be, and I haven't heard boo since then, so I don't think anything is going on there yet. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about the social web. One thing that we've talked about a lot on the show is the confusion that can happen when you're using social media accounts in a work-related way. There has been a lawsuit going on for some time that we've talked about on the show before. It's called EdCom. Linda Eagle is the person whose LinkedIn account was implicated here. Basically, she was locked out of her LinkedIn account. Her company, EdCom, had all of the information that it needed to when she was no longer part of the company to maintain the account and to, you know, prevent her, I guess, from being able to access it. She, I guess it was about 4 months that she had no access and no way to be reinstated with her 4,000 plus connections in LinkedIn. And it's sort of a win, but not a big win for her. A federal judge, after 2 years of litigating this claim, has ruled that, yes, indeed, she should have had access to the account. It was her account, despite the fact that it was done in connection with her job. Some very interesting claims she asserted in the case against her employer, such as violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, invasion of privacy, misappropriation of identity and right of publicity, identity theft. And I'm not quite clear because I haven't read the case. Maybe, Sheldon, you know more about it, what claims the court actually found she won on. But although she won and the judge validated, yes, this is your account, she found that there was no damage for being deprived of access for 4 months, and she didn't get any money out of it. I think you put this one in, Sheldon?
Yes, I did. It's the ultimate, plaintiff's lawyer nightmare. It's kind of like the personal injury where they find negligence, but no damages, no harm. Mm-hmm. She threw the book. She basically threw every claim against the wall. I think it was like an 11-count complaint, conversion and whatnot. And what the court ultimately relied on here is the language of LinkedIn, the terms of service between LinkedIn and Eagle, and basically said that, you know, that even though she was using it on behalf of EdCom, that it was still she was still individually bound by the agreement, and so that they couldn't kind of like freeze her out of the 4,000 contacts. But again, as they pointed out, what is the harm? You know, it's not like the people of EdCom were required to take the account. And it's hard to measure really what you get out of LinkedIn. We all think it's a great networking thing and there might be some business that comes out of it and whatnot, but it's hard to quantify. What this reminded me of was in another context, another social media context, another case down in Evans' neck of the woods again, Illinois. Remember the phone dog Kravitz case, which involved a guy who left the company and went to work for a rival and took 17,000 Twitter followers with him.
Right.
And it was a big dust up about that. And he, there were claims about right of publicity and a Lanham Act was in there. There was another case as well, but yeah, there was that case. And then there was another case in Illinois, involving sort of a fake Twitter account. This is where a woman had, she worked for this company and would send tweets from this company, and she was incapacitated at one point from a car accident, and her boss continued to send tweets from her account while she was out of the program. And so then she sued for Right of Publicity and Lanham Act and stuff like that. And the court had found that there was a legitimate commercial injury based on the deceptive use of her name. So, you know, so far in all these kinds of cases, the courts tend to, say these accounts belong to an individual. This was different than the other cases I mentioned in that, eagle. And this is here we're dealing with a sore eagle instead of an eagle soaring. But we're dealing with, in this case, she had openly let the company, she gave them her password and all that stuff. So she knew that they were using all this stuff. I guess she didn't expect to get squeezed out by them. And then lose access to all her, contacts that she had cultivated.
Evan, we've been talking a lot on the show lately about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. I think it's interesting how it's implicated in these kinds of cases where people are sharing access with their employer, possibly in violation of a site's own terms of service. So you've got that unauthorized access issue that comes up under the CFAA. Again, I'm not sure which claims she prevailed on here. But would you be surprised if she were able to prevail on the CFAA claim that she asserted, given that she knew that she was posting in a work-related capacity? And let's assume, I don't know all the facts of the case, but let's assume that she had given the company access, password, credentials, et cetera.
She had, yes.
She had, okay.
Yes, and... indeed, she did not prevail on her CFAA claim. The court threw that out on summary judgment a few months ago. Okay. What she did prevail on at trial, and what we have, from a few days ago, is the judge's findings of fact and conclusion of law, which is the thing that judges do when there's been a non-jury trial. And so she prevailed on her – these are all under Pennsylvania law. I think it was only state law claims that remained, at least on the plaintiff's side.
Common law stuff,
yeah, she prevailed on – unauthorized use of her name, right of publicity, invasion of privacy, misappropriation of publicity. I guess there's a distinction there between unauthorized use of her name and misappropriation of publicity under Pennsylvania law. So, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim had gotten thrown out, but not because of the question of unauthorized access, because I think the undisputed facts show that she indeed let other people use her login credentials to update her profile from time to time and put new content up and all that. The reason the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim got tossed out was on the element of damages. She could not show that somebody else accessing her account caused the kind of damages that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act requires, impairment of the system, the destruction of data, something like that. So that's the reason that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim failed. And that's the reason why I think that it's kind of a tempest in the teapot, this whole question of the overbreadth of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, at least in the civil context. I recognize Aaron Swartz et al. Risk criminal prosecution, indeed Aaron Swartz was criminally prosecuted. And the big concern on the EFF and ACLU is that everybody's going to be prosecuted for violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act just for violating the terms of service. But at least in the civil context, we see very often that those kinds of cases fail, like they did in the Eagle case here, because of that lack of the actual compensable damages that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act requires in the civil context. So that's why Eagle's Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim failed. And that's, as the years go by and lawyers are citing to this case in their briefs, they won't be citing to the conclusions of law or findings of fact and conclusions of law that just came out here after the jury trial and these questions of Pennsylvania state law. They'll be citing to that summary judgment order that dismissed the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim. Right. That's the significant takeaway from this case now that it's said and done, at least at the trial court level.
And again, let's try and give our viewers and listeners something practical to take away from this. Your relationship with a company when you're a co-founder is one thing, but when you're leaving, it's quite another. And so, Sheldon, how would you advise people to handle their work-related social media accounts and credentials?
Well, I mean, you obviously can't be as, free and easy and letting your employer in on this, but more, so you have to sit down and have a policy worked out. You have to, contemplate these kinds of things. If there is a separation agreement, who gets this and whatnot. Cause she, it was a crazy situation where when she left, Edcom, was given public notice that she wasn't with them anymore, but that information wasn't able to get to her 4,000 contacts in the LinkedIn account. So it's just the general thing with social media, the lack of sophistication, it's turning into a big thing that's sort of peripherally related in the estate realm, where people are, dying and they, their survivors don't know the passwords to their accounts and Facebook and all that kind of stuff. It's, now estate planners are, lawyers are sitting down saying, you've got to provide, when you have those letters, put that, that you give to your executrix, make sure that there's something, that information is contained in there. And so the same thing, it's just something you can preempt by working out with your employer, what happens if, if there's a separation, that goes with you or it doesn't go with you or whatever.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Well, sorry?
I just couldn't let him say the word executrix without making a comment about it. They wear a lot of black leather, right? There's no one.
Well, I was going to say, as far as the CFAA, maybe what will come out of this is, we're kind of reaching a stage now that if you have a murder case, if there's no CFAA claim, I think lawyers are not looking at it as carefully as they should, and it is sort of the flavor du jour. And so I think you're right. If they look and see about the damages requirement, maybe it won't be quite as won't be the automatic count that it is now in so many cases.
It's kind of ironic too. I mean, the only real use I get out of LinkedIn these days is it advises me when people I know have switched jobs. So it couldn't do that for Linda Eagle, given the circumstances she was in. All right, let us move on. Probably the most, one of the early and best uses of the social web comes in the form of Chilling Effects, chillingeffects.org, which has been out there for a really long time. It is a way that people have been able to post their DMCA takedown notices and other demand letters that they have received that has asked them to remove content for some legal reason. And it's a wonderful resource. People can comment on these letters, give their own responses to the legal soundness of what's being asserted there. There is a database of information that deals a lot with First Amendment, with fan fiction, all kinds of stuff over at Chilling Effects. And as we've talked about recently on the show, several companies now are making available on Chilling Effects the DMCA and other takedown notices that they receive, such as Google and Microsoft and Twitter. So now there is an argument being asserted, however. It's not too difficult to see how if there is a database of things that are being requested to be taken down, that information might be valuable not just to people with a legal interest in whether the stuff stays up or what legal issues are involved, but in people who are interested in finding illegal content on the internet. And Chilling Effects does not redact the lists of links that are included in these demand letters that it makes public. We're starting to see requests for takedowns of the takedown notices over on Chilling Effects. Evan, was this just a matter of time?
I guess so. I mean, I was surprised I hadn't, I'm surprised we haven't heard about this before, because it seems pretty intuitive if you're going to take it at from the situation of the copyright owner that, there are all these links to infringing content. And I don't know what the percentage is of links that are there where the content has actually been taken down and where those, like, say, for example, where Google doesn't disable the link to that infringing content. So whenever I have any doubts about this or wonder how to analyze it, I just think to myself, well, this is Wendy Seltzer's site, right? Didn't she start Chilling Effects back in 2001? She's been on the show at least once or twice before. Brilliant lawyer when it comes to these things. I mean, she's just,
and it's a cooperative site between, I think, Berkeley and Stanford and Yale and Harvard's technology law clinics.
Yeah. So, I mean, among those groups you just named, there are, you know, a few smart people who mm-hmm. who've thought through these things. So, you know, there seems to be like a missing link here, which is equivalent to fair use. And I don't think that it's purely a fair use argument, because what we're talking about here is the liability that would arise, or I guess it would be the safe harbor protection that would arise, not liability, but the safe harbor protection that would arise from taking this stuff down. So if, say, Microsoft, for example, I think is one who's kind of complaining about this, or at least there was a picture of Steve Ballmer at the top of this article, which led me to think that it's Microsoft who's one of the parties who are upset about this. You know, if they were to assert a cause of action against Chilling Effects for this, it would have to be some sort of indirect copyright and for some secondary liability for infringement by having provided these links. So I don't know how they could necessarily, how a plaintiff in that situation could successfully assert a cause of action that would make it all the way through without mm-hmm. getting tossed out, because of this countervailing interest that is motivating this, these documents to be put on Chilling Effects in the first place, you know, this public right. interest type of thing. So I just don't see how it would actually play out that there could be a liability to attach to Chilling Effects on this. That just sets aside whether they're, and this is a completely subjective analysis, depending on where you're coming from, whether they're being responsible internet citizens by providing these links. Clearly their sensibilities are, the conclusion that they've drawn is that it serves the public interest in a weightier fashion to shine this light on these practices, add some transparency to this, use whatever optics metaphor you want to, mm-hmm. you know, that outweighs any downside of providing links to infringing content for those who want to exploit it for their own piracy uses.
The article that we're looking at, and again, you can see all our discussion point articles at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/206 is this week's episode, is referring to, as reported in Google's transparency report, 232 requests to Google to take down links to Chilling Effects. But I'm wondering, Sheldon, if you know whether Chilling Effects is also posting the takedown notices that it must receive from time to time. Have you checked for that?
No, I have to admit that
It seems intuitive to me that they must do that as well.
You would think.
You would think.
Because, again, Google and transparency, you don't often hear those in the same sentence. It's like an oxymoron. I suspect the Chilling Effects is doing that, and that it does provide a sort of a blueprint for people with nefarious aims. But as Evan says, you know, there's the on balance, it also serves, you know, their goals are noble, and you know there is this liability and damages question. So,
there are a couple of ways that people can use the information that's in these takedown requests. They can either, you know, hunt for and hope that, despite the fact that a takedown request has been sent, the targeted content is still out there and available at that link, which is probably not too likely. But over at Torrent Freak, they point out another way that people seeking to cover their online tracks might find Chilling Effects data useful, and that is to check the notices to see what content is being monitored. What are the rights holders paying attention to? You know, if you download that, are you more likely to get caught than if you download something else? So there are a couple of ways that, you know, the folks who are attempting to dodge the law can use this information. Evan, do you think that Chilling Effects should redact?
I don't know. It just goes back to that question of how responsible they want to be. I think it'd be a lot of work. And, you know, but they're at the same time, they could probably still serve the same public interest in just as meaningful of a way by redacting, because what I understand its real mission to be is to, you know, make people aware of the extent to which DMCA takedown notices are being sent, and to let the public evaluate on its own the merits of these claims or the frivolousness of these claims. And those judgments can be made with just as much clarity and as much reliability, whether or not the particular long string URL is there character by character, bit by bit, string by string, or if it's fuzzied out, you know, in the last little part. And there we go. We've come full circle. Didn't we start the show talking about fuzziness?
Fuzzy things.
So there, finally, we're warm and fuzzy about something again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why not redact? You know, you could. I guess you could still, you know, chilling effects could still serve that interest in the same way.
All right. Any final thoughts on this, Sheldon?
No.
All right, let's move on to something else that impacts the social web, and that is Maryland appears to be the latest of states attempting to enact cyberbullying legislation. There is a bill that, let's see if it has been passed yet. I have the marked up draft linked from, again, Mike Masnick's site, Tech Dirt. Status seems to be that it's been approved, Sheldon. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe it's so. Let me see here. Try to remember. Yeah, I believe it has. Guys. You know, which puts, I mean, a lot of states have, and it's there are more egregious examples than this. I think I know Indiana and Arizona and Texas one I could weigh in on in a moment or two, but this, yeah, I think this has gone forward.
Right. So this one, I mean, it's the concern here is that obviously there are a lot of concerns in play here. People want children to be safe on the internet and not be subjected to things that are scary or bullying. But on the other hand, you know, the laws in the real world that prevent bullying by minors are probably not as draconian or effective as these online laws could be, and also not as broad. Reading the text of the Maryland bill, for example, that does seem to have passed, what it says, you know, after it goes through all its definitions of what constitutes a computer service and what it's talking about. A person may not maliciously engage in a course of conduct through the use of electronic communication that alarms or seriously annoys another with the intent to harass, alarm, or annoy the other after giving a reasonable warning or request to stop by or on behalf of the other, and without a legal, after receiving a warning or request to stop, and without a legal purpose. So I haven't read through this enough to know what the teeth of the law are, Sheldon. Do you know what the penalties are here if you run afoul of this alarm or annoy provision?
In this particular statute, I don't. But I know in several others that, you know, they're very serious. And that's what alarm. I mean, you know, the point is well taken in this article. I actually disagree. I think, you know, the article mentions it said that you know, cyberbullying is a pretty minor thing, and I don't think I subscribe to that. It's had a tremendous impact. There've been, you know, some cases in which, you know, kids have been driven to you know, extreme acts and suicide and whatnot. So I don't think it's a big minimal. But I think what is legitimate in this article and in the Maryland law and in these other states is usually the inartful drafting. You know, if you're gonna haul folks off in handcuffs, you got to be careful with using words like, you know, seriously annoying, which is like, you know, siblings everywhere saying, "Oh, my sister's seriously annoying. Can we take her away?" You know, I think that's a problem. Indiana had an anti-cyberbullying statute that prohibited You know, it talked about punishing tortious acts such as defamation and juvenile acts. And it didn't define what a juvenile act was. And
I think we're perpetrating one right now.
Yeah, that could very well be. You know, the flaw in that particular statute was like, you know, if you blogged, school is a terrible place. You could have been, running afoul of it. In Texas, the way they did their cyberbullying law, they basically passed an online impersonation measure, I think a few years ago, 2009, I think, and it was a third degree felony. You could go to like 10 years in jail if you because you had a situation there where some kids were bullying another kid by co-opting and pretending to be that person and sending out all kinds of nasty statements about it. Arizona, I think it's again, there's like they treat it like a misdemeanor, so but still 6 months in jail, and they talk about terrifying, intimidating, threatening, harassing, annoying, or offending another, and they don't define. It's very vague when you talk about annoy or offend, and I think that's where the concern, the First Amendment issue comes up and the chilling effect that could have. So that's legitimate, but I think mostly it's just a matter of sloppy drafting. If you just get some legislators who define the terms that they put in, a lot of this would go away.
Walter Olson has a nice critique of this law over at cato.org and points out that there are some exceptions from this law, exemptions for political views or conveying information. So even if your political views are annoying or alarming, that would be okay. But then he goes on to say that it's a curious pair of exemptions, since it's long been assumed that our First Amendment protects many types of seriously annoying speech other than just those two things. So, Evan, are you alarmed that states are enacting laws like this? And is it going to be up to the federal government to enact something more reasonable and controlling?
I don't think that we should feel any better if the federal government were to try to do something like this. Mm-hmm. We've got the federal protections, the First Amendment and the state constitutions, their equivalents for protecting the free speech interests like this. I think what the real phenomenon is behind these things is the political bitcoins that legislators get from enacting legislation like this, even if it is unconstitutional, because at least they can go back to their constituency and say, look at this noble battle that I am fighting on behalf of our children, and look at what an evil world we live in, where these laws that I'm presenting are shot down, but at least I'm fighting the good fight. So I think that has a way of making this much less of a rational area in which legislatures try to regulate in this, because of this interest that we have in protecting children. Obviously a compelling interest, but to the same extent, difficult to craft legislation that is narrowly tailored to meet that interest because of the linguistic problems that we've discussed so far in this. What do these things mean for them to be irritating or to be harassing or in different contexts obscene and so easily sweep in language that clearly is protected by the First Amendment? So it's a Herculean task to ever do this the correct way, whether it's the state government or the federal government.
All right. Well, we thank you, the Sue in IRC, for reminding me we need a second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. So let's make it cyberbullying, given our last discussion there. And just remind you that if you are interested in receiving either legal or other educational credit for the show, we have a page on the Twit Wiki that will give you lots more information about that. And we drop these passphrases into the show in case you have to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened. So there you go. We hope that is helpful for you. We probably have time to do one more story, Sheldon. We've got a bunch more in the rundown, so I'm going to let you pick which one is most interesting to you.
Let's see. Or which one doesn't seriously annoy me? So put it that way, I guess.
Or alarm you.
Or alarm me, right. I actually thought the defamation, the prior restraint case against the Haitian prime minister brought was an interesting case to me.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, I had blogged about it at the time it happened, and I was glad to see that common sense prevailed in the end. That the judge took a deep breath and thought about it. It is a just pulling up to my entirely off the cuff spontaneous notes on this so that I don't misstate them. yes, here we go. Basically, what happened is you had a the Haitian prime minister, a fellow named Lamothe, and a business person were targeted by a journalist, a Haitian journalist, they basically, just talking about alleged that they had been involved, that they had benefited from some sweetheart deal involving a Haitian telecommunication company, that the prime minister had gone to bat on behalf of the business person, and both of them were, fat and happy as a result. And so they sued the publication and the journalist and sought an injunctive order against them and obtained it. And part of the injunction was that this reporter and the publication could never, ever, ever write about or publish anything about the Haitian prime minister again. Or the Florida business, and that was just staggering to me. It brought to mind, the Neer versus Minnesota case in 1931, that even predates me. But if you remember that Supreme Court case, if you're familiar with it, there was a very over. Fred Friendly wrote a book about the case, actually called Minnesota Rag. But it was there was a very overbroad restrictive order in that case, in which the judge ordered a newspaper, had pulled offending newspapers off the shelf, said that he had to see any other copies of that, that newspaper would publish in the future to make sure they weren't violating his injunction. And if they decided to get clever and come up with another publication under a different name, he had to see that as well. It was incredibly overbroad. And the Supreme Court tossed it. It was actually the first time, I think, that the Supreme Court, the First Amendment win. It was the first Amendment win for the news media. And, and that case and this and many other kinds just sort of reflect what courts are always hesitant to do about stepping in the shoes of an editor, serving an editorial function. I mean, it's such an obvious prior restraint, the First Amendment, it hasn't even been written yet. You haven't written anything about the Haitian prime minister. But, so if you were planning to write, I think I've been hasty. He's actually a swell guy, or he's a terrific dancer or something like that. You would have been violating this judge's order because it was so broad. He could never write anything about him. And what the judge wound up doing is he dismissed the case. But he did say that his initial prior restraint order was unconstitutional. But otherwise he tossed it out on really kind of procedural things, saying, the complaint hadn't been properly served, that there had been, sloppily or improperly pleaded actual malice. So, he actually dismissed it, without prejudice. So if the Haitian prime minister wants to flex his muscles again, he could, bring this case again. But if he does, I'm sure he's not going to get an injunction because it does so fly in the face of the First Amendment.
Right. But it raises some interesting issues about international law and sovereignty and honoring judgments from other countries in the U.S. Here, the judgment was obtained in Haiti, correct? The prior restraint order. But it was obtained in a default way. In other words,
that's right. That's right. The Haitian journalist is based in the United States, mm-hmm. And so he went off after him. So yes, that's true.
So he never appeared in Haiti to defend, and the requested order was just enacted because nobody appeared to object or defend against it. And then they trot on over to Miami and try and enforce it, and the court says no. But leaving the door open to amend and possibly come back into court on it. But it seems like, you know, there are at least two issues here of, you know, to what extent does an order issued in Haiti have effect in the United States? And to what extent can a court ignore it if it was entered in a default way like this? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think we have, I think we can ignore. I mean, you know, there was a response, for example, and also in the context of defamation, when England was becoming, you know, I don't know if you've done libel tourism before, but England was a favorable place to bring libel cases because unlike here, where, you know, the burden of proof is on the, you know, defamed, the alleged defamed public figure or public official in England, it's still on the media defendant to show that what it published was true and whatnot. So they, there were magazines that, you know, US-based magazines or newspapers or whatnot that sold maybe a couple of copies in England, but were available. People, plaintiffs were running out to sue in England. And as a consequence of that, Congress passed a law that the President Obama signed saying that, you know, we're not going to enforce these foreign judgments if they run afoul of the First Amendment. So I think, you know, they are trying to foreclose some of that. But you know, with the Internet and everything, we see all the time the influence of other laws on our law or on behavior of our parties. I'm thinking specifically off the top of my head of Yahoo or what was it, Yahoo or eBay or something. Remember, they had the Nazi memorabilia that was for sale. And in Germany and France, you know, they have laws against that. Whereas here we figure, you know, it's just we try to combat it with other speech, you know, or something saying how untoward it is or whatever. And so I think, you know, that there is a an avenue through which I think we could be susceptible. But we did foreclose some of it with that. With I think speech, it was this really screwy acronym is for what the law was called, but Congress passed and the president signed in to protect defamation plaintiffs here from foreign judgments.
So, Evan, do you have any thoughts on this case or do you have anything that you'd like to publish about the Haitian prime minister since you are not banned from doing so?
No. Wasn't Wycliffe John going to run for prime minister of Haiti?
Yes, right.
So I guess it's not him. I guess he didn't run and he didn't get elected. So this isn't him. He's not gone till November. So the relevance I see to this has just got a more abstract general level and goes to that really fundamental First Amendment issue of prior restraint, because this comes up in a practical sense a lot with clients, you know, people who are the subject of rough treatment online. You know, they want this stuff to stop and to never happen again. And that's such a difficult conversation to have with people who are aggrieved by stuff that's being said about them online. That, you know, we have this First Amendment right, and the First Amendment then becomes such a painful thing for people. So it just, this, you know, kind of underscores the importance of that and the high price that some people pay for the sake of us all to, you know, to have this First Amendment right to be free from prior restraints. I guess the other point I would want to comment on is that statute that you were talking about, that law that was enacted, Sheldon, that President Obama signed early in his administration. I remember that, you know, also kind of validating the immunities that Section 230 provides. Like if,
that's right.
You know, so if somebody were to sue an intermediary for defamation in England or anywhere else for that matter, in contravention of the principles that are in Section 230, which immunize the service provider there for the tortious content distributed by its crazy user, we wouldn't here in the United States recognize those judgments as well. So that seems like something just as important for the sake of the health of our internet infrastructure and the continued
growth. I remember the acronym for the viewers who are anxiously waiting. It was securing the protection of our enduring established constitutional heritage. See, it's really lame. It's very forced to make it be speech, but that's what it was. Securing the protection of our enduring established constitutional heritage.
Yeah. I'm getting misty-eyed.
It's like out of a bad movie.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, we have not one, but two, count them two, tips of the week and two, count them two, resources of the week to give you. Sometimes we have a plethora. Sometimes we come up empty. This week, we've got a bunch to share with you. Let's start with the tips. Evan, you had one and I had one. Why don't you do the YouTube one first?
The one that I found was sent to me by... a guy I know that we follow each other on Twitter. It was guidelines that YouTube has distributed for using the YouTube logo. This is all in furtherance of YouTube's branding issues, saying, you know, how you can use the YouTube logo correctly. There's no short URL for it, but if you probably do a Google search for using the YouTube logo, you would come to this page. But, you know, just talks about using the appropriate spacing and sizing, and actually points out some errors, how YouTube does not want you to use the logo. This all goes toward protecting, you know, the integrity of the trademark, those trademark rights that YouTube enjoys, making sure that it's properly policing its the public's use of this mark. So kind of an interesting resource. They're not discouraging, certainly not discouraging the public's use of this logo. But wow, wouldn't that be ironic if they were, given that YouTube is social media and the whole point of it is for sharing and collaboration and all this stuff. So just some interesting things to keep in mind there if you want to exercise best practices in your web and other platform design.
Yeah, I found this really interesting. Circulate. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'm sure it was circulated internally at the Viacom, you know, make sure that they don't mess up with it.
Yes. I found this really interesting that, you know, YouTube doesn't want you monkeying around with the logo and gives you examples of what not to do. And also that they drop in this preference. You know, they don't require you. They don't say they're going to come after you if you do this. But you know how social media buttons tend to be little squares, you know, for Facebook and Twitter and Google+, et cetera. Mm-hmm. YouTube prefers that you not use a little square, which it calls its stacked logo. It likes you to use the full one in a small size, even though it's not a square tile. I have no idea why they would express such a preference, but you know, they've gone to the effort of expressing it here. So if you want to honor YouTube, then bear that in mind. And then my tip is along the same lines. And that is, if you're going to have a giveaway or a sweepstakes on Facebook, a lot of businesses like to do that to promote their pages and their online presence there. In addition to all of the myriad laws you have to comply with regarding sweepstakes and lotteries and making sure that your sweepstakes doesn't become a lottery by making people exchange something of value in order to be able to participate. Facebook has its own, you know, talk about code as law. Facebook has its own set of requirements if you're going to run one of these things on the site. So in addition to knowing the laws of all the 50 states, you have to know the laws of Facebook if you're going to do one of these giveaways. And they have a page guidelines page that lays these things out. Apparently they have an offer tool where you can do offers and promotions using that offer creation tool. But then if you're going to do your own promotion outside that tool, they have a bunch of rules that apply to that. They require you to use a third-party application to administer your promotion that you're running. They require you to communicate with the winners in a means outside of Facebook. So even though you are, you know, communicating about this thing on the Facebook platform, when somebody has won, you can't send them a Facebook mail. You can't put it on your page's wall. You have to have their email or phone or physical address to get in touch with them, because Facebook doesn't want you using its platform to do that. So there are a bunch of little hoops to jump through there that it's worth bearing in mind if you're a business running that kind of promotion. And then our two resources, one of them I referred to earlier, and it's this great piece someone on Twitter pointed me toward at Torrent Freak called "Don't Download That, Bro, You're Gonna Get Busted," that is assuming and acknowledging that people out there are still using things like BitTorrent or other file sharing tools to obtain unauthorized access to copyrighted materials. And it's got a very nice overview of the kinds of penalties you might be subject to if you are, depending on what jurisdiction you're living in. They cover Switzerland, Germany, the Netherlands, France, New Zealand, and of course the United States. They talk about six strikes, and they have, what I mentioned earlier was, this notion that you could somehow discern what's being monitored in different ways to sort of, you know, lower your odds of getting caught, I assume is the point here. And, they mentioned chilling effects in that regard and some other things you can do. Anyway, it's a really interesting article, and I like, the sort of jurisdiction by jurisdiction breakdown of the penalties involved. And then other resource of the week, as CISPA is coming up for a House vote. That is the, let me get this acronym right, Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, the one that involves personal information provided to online businesses, perhaps being shared with government agencies in service of security and anti-terrorism. The EFF and ACLU recently did an Ask Me Anything AMA on this. So if you have more questions about CISPA and want to communicate with your lawmakers as this bill continues to wend its way through the legislative process, this is a good resource to get the EFF and ACLU's take on the law. This happened 2 days ago. So again, all this will be in our discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/206.
Asher's a California. I'm sorry. I was just going to say there was one of a California legislator who's just introduced an amendment to this bill, CISPA, that would remove any personal identifiable information prior to the information being shared with the government or other companies. It was Adam Schiff, I think, S-C-H-I-F-F. So that's happened since the original posting on the rundown.
Great. Well, that's good to know. And again, yes, this law is a moving target, and it's highly controversial, as I'm sure folks listening and watching know. Again, I think it's great that EFF and our friend Trevor Tim and some other great folks participated in this Q&A to try and shed some light on what folks may be subjected to if this passes. Any other final thoughts, Evan, before we go ahead and wrap?
No, it's been a fun conversation. Really have enjoyed it. I think we've, if we say any more, I would just be making it up at this point, which may or may not be. May or how may not be that any different than the beginning of the show. Yeah,
exactly. How would that be any different than any of our shows? Sheldon, it has been so wonderful having you join us again. Tell us what you're up to these days.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I'm ratcheting up, besides my teaching, I've media law, and I actually taught an online media law course at Emerson for the first time last term. I'm doing law, a lot of civil litigation in this company called The Right Lawyer.
Very nice. All right. And you can find Sheldon. He writes the wonderful The Unruly of Law blog, play on words from The Rule of Law. And he is The Unruly of Law on Twitter. Go find him over there. You can find us every Friday recording live at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC at twit.tv. We love it when you join us live and jump into IRC and play around with us there. If you can't do that, of course, the shows are going to be available for you on your own time, however you would like to space and time shift them. Head on over to twit.tv/twill for the full archive of shows and directions on how you can consume them on any platform you would like, really. So we hope that we can join your life in ways that are convenient for you. We hope that we have shed some light and that we can continue to on the difficult legal issues involved in using technology and the web. And next week, I'm not going to be around, but it's going to be an amazing, amazing show. I have to just encourage you to tune in next week on the 19th because we've got the Law and the Multiverse guys joining us. Ryan Davidson, and who's the other one, Evan? Do you remember?
Ryan Kahlo.
Ryan, oh, well, no, I know that, Ryan Kahlo is also joining us, but I was thinking of the other Law and the Multiverse guy.
Who's
coming
it?
On? Let me look it up here.
Oh,
my gosh.
We haven't talked to him before, so.
No, they haven't been on the show before. Yes, Ryan Kahlo has. He is, of course, the world's greatest robot law geek. just having hosted the We Robot conference over at Stanford. The Law and the Multiverse guys are James Daly and Ryan Davidson. And yes. they write about all things related to law as it comes up in fantasy worlds. And of course, Ryan Kahlo deals with law as it happens in the real world of robotics and might unfold in the future. So I just think you've got a real all-star panel lined up next week, Evan, yeah. And I wish I could be there.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I mean, what if the singularity happens between now and then? That's only going to make it even more interesting. So it should be a blast. So yeah, everybody come back this same time next week, and we're going to have a great talk about robots and AI and, you know, the crazy future world that we'll yes. be in.
Will you promise me you'll talk about LARPing?
We can.
I want to see what they think about legal agreements that may be entered into, both in virtual worlds, you know, Second Life. Is Second Life even a thing anymore? Whatever the successors to that kind of experience might be. And also, you know, if you are engaging in a fantasy kind of activity involving a fantasy storyline and agreements you may enter into there, what sort of enforceability there might be.
Oh my God, you are a nerd. It's amazing.
I think it's a fascinating question.
For sure.
All right. Yes. All right. Well, this has been really, really fun. Thank you so much, Sheldon, again for joining us.
Thank you.
We hope to see you again soon, and we hope to see all of you again soon when we record This Week in Law. Take care.